So let's cultivate our motivation. And if we think 106 degrees is hot, then we can imagine what living beings in other realms are experiencing in terms of heat and cold. And remember that the experiences of all these realms and the realms themselves are all created by our mind, in the sense that through our mind we act mentally, verbally, and physically, and these actions are karma. Then leave potencies on our mind that affect our future lives, the experiences we have there, the kind of environments we're born into, and so on. And just as for us, our human realm and human experiences seem very real, similarly for beings in other situations, other realms, their experiences seem just as real. So we have the fortune to have precious human lives now, especially to have met the Dharma. So let's listen to what His Holiness the Dalai Lama says with an open mind, an open heart, and try and practice it well, so we can become Buddhas and act wholly for the welfare of other living beings. Last week we started on chapter one, exploring Buddhism. And we talked about the purpose and existence and the meaning of our life. We talked about the middle way between theistic religions and scientific reductionism. And today we're starting on the section of Buddha Dharma and other religions. So here you can see His Holiness is really placing where Buddha Dharma fits in terms of other religions, in terms of science and society and so on. Okay, so he begins here. He says, there are two aspects to each religion. One is transformation of the mind or heart. The other is the philosophy that supports that transformation. I believe that in terms of transforming human beings' minds and hearts, all religions are in general agreement. Okay, general agreement, not 100%, but general. They all teach love, compassion, forgiveness, non-harm, contentment, self-discipline, and generosity, and many other qualities as well. No matter the religion, a person who practices it sincerely will develop these qualities. In every religion, we see many examples of ethical and warm-hearted people who benefit others. Okay, so in the whole field of religion, yeah, all religions are having the same purpose on in terms of how they're teaching people to behave and the values that they're teaching. Okay, ethical conduct and so on. Okay, now within ethical conduct, they may have differences. You know, you generally the thing is not to kill human beings. Yeah, but they have different ideas. For example, about killing animals, in Christianity, animals are here for human enjoyment and use, and it's okay to kill them. Okay, in Buddhism, that's not okay. You know, so there's differences, but in general, you know, there's a very similar approach. Okay. But the difference among religions occurs mainly in the area of philosophy. Okay. Theistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and many branches of Hinduism, believe in a supreme being who created the universe and the living beings in it. Theistic philosophy supplies the reasons for the adherents of these religions to transform their hearts and minds. For them, all existence depends on the Creator. The Creator created us and loves us, and so in return, with gratitude, we love the Creator. Because we love the Creator, we must then love the creations, other sentient beings, and treat them respectfully. This is the reason for our Jewish, Christian, Hindu, and Muslim brothers and sisters to be kind and ethical people. Okay? So that's probably what we learned in Sunday school, those of us who grew up in Judeo-Christian contexts. You know, the Creator created us out of love. Again, we ignore all the questions that come with that. So our job is to return love to the Creator. And since the Creator's creations are a reflection of the Creator, to love the creations, other sentient beings. Okay, so that's the philosophy supporting being kind and being ethical people. Okay, and for people who believe that, it works well. Yeah, it makes sense to them. It helps them to be kind people. Of course, we see that all people who call themselves Christian or Jewish or Muslim or Hindu or whatever have their own various interpretations of what these things mean, you know, as witnessed by God being on our side every time we go to war to kill people, you know, and all the ways in which we abuse religion and religious philosophy to justify wrongdoing in the world. Yeah, so that's universal across all religions, but the theory behind the religion in terms of why to be kind and respectful, all religions have some kind of philosophy supporting that. But that doesn't mean everybody who calls themselves a member of that religion follows that philosophy or follows those principles. Okay, so when people come to me and say, how come, you know, this Buddhist figure does this and that, you know, something negative. They never ask me why people do positive things. They always ask me why people do negative things. Then I have to say, I don't know, because I can't read that other person's mind. And then I remind them, not all Buddhists are Buddhas. And not all Christians are Christ, and so on, you know. The religions present the ideal, and people try and meet that ideal in various degrees. Okay. So Buddhism, on the other hand, speaks not of an external creator, but of the law of causality. So this is a major difference here. Our actions create the causes for what we will experience in the future. If we want happiness, be it temporal happiness in samsara, or the happiness that comes through spiritual realizations, we must abandon destructive actions and practice love, compassion, tolerance, forgiveness, and generosity. Okay, and other things. So here the reason for respecting others and treating them well is that our actions, how we treat others, has an effect on us as well. And the bottom line is, since we want happiness ourselves, we should try and be kind to others because those actions in the long term bring the happiness to ourselves. Okay. Of course, as we practice Buddhism more and more, we go beyond that initial motivation of just practicing ethics and generosity and so on, so that we'll experience the good results. Okay, we go way beyond that kind of motivation, but we got to start somewhere. While big differences exist among their philosophies, all religions agree on the good qualities for human beings to develop. For some people, the Buddhist philosophy is more effective in cultivating these qualities. For others, the doctrine of another religion is more helpful. Therefore, from the viewpoint of an individual, each person will see one philosophy as true and one religion as best for him or her. But looking at all of society, we must accept the diversity and plurality of religion and of views of truth. These two perspectives, what is best for a given individual and what is best for society, do not contradict each other. So this comes up again and again in His Holiness's explanations. He'll talk about, for a specific individual, this practice is good, or doing things this way is good, or, in this case, Buddhist philosophy suits this particular individual and helps them to live a good life, okay? So what is best for an individual is not necessarily best for all of society, okay? So in terms of all of society, we have to accept that there's so much diversity and that what is good for one person is not necessarily the most effective philosophy or religion for another person. Okay? So that's why as Buddhists, we don't go around saying Buddhism is the best religion, everybody should be Buddhist, you know, join our team. We don't do that because we realize that people have different mentalities and different interests. And so everybody's got to find what is suitable for them that helps them become a better person. So it's similar to, when we have a big buffet, some people like rice, some people like noodles, some people like, you know, a lot of vegetables, and some people like a lot of fruit, and some people like dal, and other people don't. And so on a big buffet, everybody takes what suits them best, but the effect for everybody is that everybody is nourished, okay, even though they eat different foods that nourish them. So in the same way here, you know, people may have different philosophies, but each person is nourished spiritually by their own philosophy, you know. And so on a societal level, we really need to accept the diversity and plurality, yeah. And so within all these religions, you know, sometimes you see that people, in order to say that religions should be harmonious with each other, they say, well, they all come to the same point. And I don't know about you, but I can't say that truthfully because I haven't even attained the point of my own religion, let alone the final goal of other religions. So how can I say they all lead to the same place? Yeah, I think that's kind of impossible to say. And it's also not necessary to say that they all lead to the same place. His Holiness is very good friends with one Catholic or Episcopalian father from the UK. They're very good friends, and they speak together sometimes in Bodh Gaya and so on. And the Catholic father, you know, would say, oh, well, Buddhism and Catholicism are the same. And His Holiness would say, no, there's points in which we differ. Yeah, and that's completely okay. We can still get along even though we don't agree on every point. Okay. In the West, we kind of think that for us to get along, we have to agree on everything. And so that's why we want to say that all religions lead to the same point. Okay. But His Holiness is showing a different alternative. We don't have to all believe in the same things, but we can still get along. Yeah. So I think this is significant in all of our dealings with other people. Yeah. of what other traditions or other beliefs or other ways of acting or whatever. You know, we can have different ideas, but we can still get along. I think that's quite important to remember. Okay? And to remember, as he says here, what is best for an individual and what is best for society can be different, but that doesn't contradict, the two things don't contradict each other. Okay? Even within Buddhism, our teacher, the Buddha, taught different philosophies to different people because he understood that due to each individual's disposition and interest, what is suitable for one person is not necessarily effective for another. Thus, the Buddha respects the individual views, be they within Buddha Dharma itself or amongst individuals from various religions. Yeah, and so once you start studying the tenet systems, you know, and looking into the scriptures, you see, you know, the Buddha said different things to different people. Yeah, and some things what he said to one are vastly different than what he said to another. Okay, but the idea is that he, whenever he speaks, he's addressing the mentality of the people that he speaks to. And so that suits them. So what he says may not be his final version, his final teaching on that topic, but it's not lying. It's not considered lying when he teaches somebody something that is not his final version. Yeah, it's called that. It's said that he's being skillful because he's teaching them what is beneficial for them. Okay. So he's not, in the West, we think, you know, lying means, or telling the truth means every single detail is exactly the same. Yeah. And for His Holiness, it has to do with teaching people what is beneficial for them at that particular time with a motivation of compassion. And that's what is truthful. Okay, so teaching somebody a philosophy that they're going to reject, it's not considered skillful, and, you know, it may not be considered completely truthful either. Okay, so this series is written mainly for Buddhist practitioners, so some philosophical explanations naturally will not agree with people of other religions. However, as Buddhists, we do not criticize those religions or the people who practice them. From a Buddhist viewpoint, the plurality of religions in the world is beneficial, for each individual must find a belief system that is suited to his or her disposition and interests. Although the philosophy of another faith may not be correct from a Buddhist viewpoint, we must respect it if it benefits others. Okay. And that goes also for people who have no religion. Yeah, that having no religion, no faith, may be the best thing for them in that particular lifetime. So we don't criticize because we recognize people are different. Whether we accept religion or not is an individual choice. But if we accept a religion, we should be serious in following it and make our way of life concordant with its teachings. So this is important, you know. Whatever religion we follow, we should take it seriously, you know, and not bastardize it so that it agrees with our personal opinion and it rationalizes all of our negative actions. If the teachings become part of our lives, we receive true value. In politics and business, hypocrisy and deception are commonplace and regrettable. But in religion, they are totally deplorable. We must be sincere and cultivate a kind heart and tolerant, kind heart and tolerance, no matter which religion we choose. Yeah? So do our best. And you know, he said in politics and business, hypocrisy and deception are commonplace. They're regrettable. you can see how it tears people apart in society when business people or politicians lie and cheat and embezzle and so on. But when this goes on in religion, then His Holiness is saying it's totally deplorable because you're teaching one thing and you're acting exactly in the opposite way. Once I met a Chilean scientist who told me that he reminds himself not to be attached to his particular scientific field. I think the same is true regarding religion, because attachment leads to bias, which in turn brings a fundamentalist attitude that clings to a single absolute truth. While I was still young and lived in Tibet, I was a little biased against other faiths. However, upon coming to India, I met Thomas Merton, Mother Teresa, and people from many other religions. Seeing that the practice of other religions can produce wonderful people, I developed respect for other religions. So he was rather sheltered in Tibet, he admits it. And of course, you know, every country has incorrect stereotypes of other religions that they pass down from generation to generation. And so, that's why it's really important to learn about other religions and to meet people from those religions so that we don't just pass down wrong stereotypes. And especially within Buddhism, this is very, very important because so many traditions have wrong ideas about the other ones. I think I've talked about this plenty of times before. When my non-Buddhist brothers and sisters come to learn the Buddha Dharma, I usually recommend that they do not think of becoming Buddhists. Buddhism does not proselytize or seek to convert others. You should first explore the religion of your family, and if that meets your spiritual needs, practice that rather than taking on Buddhism. In that way, you will avoid the difficulties of practicing a religion that exists within a culture foreign to your own, and whose scriptures are written in languages that you do not understand. However, if your family's religion does not meet your needs, and the Buddha Dharma suits your disposition better, then of course you are free to become a Buddhist or to adopt some practices from Buddhism while retaining your previous religion. Okay, so, His Holiness in the early days, he didn't say this. He started saying this after 1990. 1990 was when there was a delegation, not delegation, or group of Jewish leaders went to have interreligious dialogue with the Tibetans and especially with His Holiness in Dharamsala. I happened to be there at the time. I wasn't able to go to the conversations they had with His Holiness, but I talked with all of them outside of that. And they were very shaken up, the Jewish leaders, by the number of what has come to be called Jubus in Dharamsala. And it's, you know, when you look, many of the, there's many Jews in Buddhism and people who are Jewish leaders, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, Alex Berzin, many, many people. And because Jews are very sensitive to their people going to other religions, then they said to His Holiness, you know, how come there are so many young Jewish people becoming Buddhists? And, you know, they had some dismay about this. And so His Holiness, you know, being sensitive to that, afterwards started really encouraging people to stay with their own religion, because he saw the kind of pain that it caused those leaders. But he also told the Jewish leaders, if you have advanced studies and mystical, or not mystical, but, you know, advanced studies and so on in Judaism, you should teach them to these young people so they don't have to look elsewhere for deeper philosophy. Okay? So, you know, like teaching the Kabbalah and so forth. So it was quite an interesting experience being there and just seeing, just seeing how they relate to each other. When the Jewish group first came, they were staying at His Holiness's brother and sister-in-law's place called Kashmiri Cottage. It's kind of like a homey hotel, which they had to make kosher. You know, they made the Kashmiri Cottage kitchen kosher. Yeah, all the Tibetans cooked kosher for the time that they were there. One of the first nights, they invited some of the Tibetan geshis and lamas and, you know, and abbots and so on, who lived in the area, to come and have dinner with the Jews. So they're, I don't know, maybe 10, 12 Jews and an equal number of Tibetans. And then some of us Jubus came as well, because we were kind of trying to help the two groups get to know, understand each other. So in Jewish tradition, on Friday night, you welcome the Shabbat, and you face Jerusalem. So when you're in India, you faced west towards Jerusalem to welcome the Sabbath bride. So as the sun was going down, and you have a beautiful sunset at Kashmiri Cottage, all the Jews are, lined up there. And they sing and they dance to welcome the Shabbat, and they're bowing and doing their whole thing facing west. And some of our Tibetan teachers were there, and they commented afterwards to us, "These people worship the sun?" And we had to explain, no, they're not sun worshipers. They face their holy city, you know, when they worship, and, you know, they weren't bowing to the sun or anything like that. So there were these kind of misunderstandings that happened. Yeah. And also for the Jews, seeing Buddha figures that look like human beings, this is horrible, you know. The Jews and the Muslims are very similar on this account, you know. It's prohibited to make any kind of image of holy beings. So when the Jews saw these kinds of images, I mean, they were just horrified. And, you know, and then the Tibetans are bowing in front of the images, and the Jews are going, "These people are idol worshipers." And we're saying, no, they're not worshiping idols. They're thinking of the qualities of these Buddhas that the statues represent. And, you know, and then we had to explain, you know, for the Tibetans, if they went to Jerusalem and they saw all the people davening Jewish prayer at the wall, you know, the West Wall, then they would say that all of you are worshiping a wall. But you know you're not worshiping a wall. So they know they're not worshiping idols. Yeah. So, but quite interesting just to see, you know, how easy it is to generate misconceptions. I had quite a lovely time. There was one rabbi there, and he and I would get together and meditate from time to time. Yeah, very wonderful rabbi. Yeah, there were very nice people there, actually. Okay, so His Holiness continues, "The reason I advise people to first investigate their family's religion..." Oh, and I should say something here. When His Holiness first started saying, "Stay with your family's religion, you know, don't convert," I was really hurt. It sounded like he's saying, you know, we don't want you to become Buddhists. But later, you know, here he's explaining what he means. And you see that's not it at all. You know, first of all, he wants other religions to know that he's not trying to convert their people. And second of all, for people's benefit, so they don't get confused, that's why he's saying it. But as we read in the last paragraph, he's saying, if Buddhism makes sense to you and your religion of birth doesn't, of course, you know, you're welcome to become a Buddhist. So he says, the reason I advise people to first investigate their family's religion is that some people become confused when they change religions. A case in point is the family of a Tibetan lay official who fled Tibet in the early 1960s after the uprising against the Chinese occupation and became refugees in India. After the father passed away, one of the many Christian missionary groups who kindly helped refugees aided his wife and children. After some years, the wife came to see me and told me her story, saying that the Christians helped her a lot and gave her children an education. So for this life, she is a Christian, but in the next life, she will be a Buddhist. Okay, so you can see the kind of confusion in people's minds. To practice and benefit from the Buddha's teachings, you do not need to be a Buddhist. If certain teachings make sense to you, help you to get along better with others, and enable your mind and heart to be clearer and more peaceful, practice those teachings within the context of your own life. The Buddha's teachings on subduing anger and cultivating patience may be practiced by Jews, Christians, Muslims, Hindus, and those who do not follow any religion. Buddhist instructions on how to develop concentration and focused attention can be used by anyone who meditates, no matter what religion or philosophy they follow. Okay? And so in this way, there's been some very fruitful interreligious exchanges. And I know at one such conference, I was teaching some of the bodhicitta meditations, you know, like on equanimity and the disadvantages of self-centeredness, benefits of cherishing others, to a group of Catholics. And they really liked those meditations. They thought they were very, very helpful. Okay. And one time I was invited to speak at a cloistered Catholic nunnery in Massachusetts. And the abbess asked me to speak to all the nuns. And so I started talking about, getting along with other people who are different than us and how people, you know, getting along with people who have different ideas and who have habits that disturb us and all that kind of stuff. And the Catholic nuns were all going like this, you know. I mean, like they got it because they have the same thing going on in their nunnery that we have going on in our communities of people who have different thoughts, thinking that their way should be followed. Yeah, so it was really rather sweet how we just all knew what we were talking about. We were definitely on the same page. If you are interested in following the Buddhist path, I recommend that you first understand the Buddhist worldview. Take your time and learn how the Buddha describes our present state, the causes of our difficulties, our potential, and the path to actualize it. In other words, the four truths. Explore the ideas of rebirth, karma and its effects, emptiness, awakening, and so on. Then, when you have some conviction arising from thoughtful reflection, you can consider following the Buddhist path. So he's telling people, really learn the teachings, you know, and when you learn them and they make sense to you, then you can consider calling yourself a Buddhist. But don't just, you know, like emotionally like, oh, Buddhism is great, or, you know, I want to take initiations, or, you know, whatever it is, and jump into things in a very blind way. So I think it's very telling that he is really telling people, you know, learn what the Buddhist worldview is. Yeah, and I think this is so important because if you don't understand the Buddhist worldview, and if the Buddhist worldview does not make sense to you, then the rest of the teachings don't make much sense to you. Yeah? But if you understand, you know, the truth of dukkha, what the origins are, what cessation is, what the path is, and you have some idea and that makes sense to you, yeah, then the other teachings are going to help you and make sense to you. Okay. Okay, now, religion in the modern world. So, again, he's placing things in a broader perspective. Once we adopt a religion, we should practice it sincerely. If we truly believe in Buddha, God, Allah, Shiva, and so forth, we should be honest human beings. Some people claim to have faith in their religion, but act counter to its ethical injunctions. They pray for the success of their dishonest and corrupt actions, asking God, Buddha, and so forth for help in covering up their wrongdoings. This is true, isn't it? So sad. People like that should give up saying they're religious. Our world now faces an ethical crisis related to lack of respect for spiritual principles and ethical values. These cannot be forced on society by legislation or by science. An ethical conduct due to fear does not work. So threatening people with going to hell or whatever is not very useful. Rather, we must think and have conviction in the worth of ethical principles so that we will want to live ethically. So very important, we want to practice the teachings. We want to live ethically. We want to abandon our anger. We want to abandon our grudges. We want to abandon our prejudice. Okay, so it's very important to following the Buddhist path that you want to do these things. If you don't really want to do them and you're doing them because you feel like you're going to be born in the lower realms or whatever, that's not the right attitude and your practice isn't going to be happy. Yeah, and so the same goes. And we've been talking in the past about the relationship with a spiritual mentor. We shouldn't follow a spiritual mentor or follow tantric commitments because we're afraid of going to hell. You know, we have to do this because we see that those practices help our mind, not because we're afraid. Okay? And I think this is really, really important. Yeah, His Holiness has taken to tell a story about, I don't know, I can't remember the whole story. Some of you may remember the whole thing. But somebody went to a monastery to visit and asked to see the abbot. And the abbot assistant was there and said, "I'm sorry, the abbot is out in the village scaring people." And how was he scaring them? He was teaching them, you know, you've got to believe this or you're going to the lower realms, that kind of stuff. Yeah. And so His Holiness, when he was doing the Yamantaka teachings in Australia, some of you may have been there, one afternoon he really spoke quite directly about this, and there, you know, to everybody, and there were some lamas there, you know, about you should not be, threatening people when you teach the Dharma, yeah? They should really want to practice and do it with a good heart. Okay. The United States and India, for example, both have good government structures even though Congress is totally dysfunctional, well, it's following the structure and it's dysfunctional. Yeah, I mean, they can't do anything except, you know, criticize each other and collect their stipend. Salary, excuse me. Yeah. Their welfare. Yeah, isn't it? Yeah. Welfare for Congress. Yeah. Best, I mean, they're not doing anything and they get paid. Yeah. Oh, sorry. I always like to poke fun at our political system. It's part of the culture here. Okay. So both have good government structures, but many of the people involved in them lack ethical principles. You bet. Self-discipline and ethical self-restraint on the part of political leaders, financial executives, those in the medical field, industrialists, teachers, lawyers, and all other citizens are needed to create a good society. But we cannot impose self-discipline and ethical principles from the outside. We need inner cultivation. That is why spirituality and religion are relevant in the modern world. Okay? Look at the argument he just made, why spirituality and religion are essential in the modern world, why it's not just about money and science, okay? Because, you know, everybody in the society needs to live ethically and live according to good principles. And this can't be legislated. It can't be pushed on people from outside. People from their own side need to want to live ethically and follow good principles. And how are they going to learn that? From spirituality and religion. So that's the need in modern times for spirituality and religion. India, where I now live, has been home to the ideas of secularism, inclusiveness, and diversity for 3,000 years. And what's really sad, this is true, I mean, the Indians are remarkably open and tolerant. And that's what makes the rise of the BJP so sad. Okay, the BJP is the Hindu Nationalist Party that was out of power, but Modi, you know, when he became prime minister, he was from that party. He brought them into power. And there's been so much more religious strife between the Hindus and the Muslims since then. Even before he came to power, there was strife. Yeah, but it's gotten worse. And it's very sad because India has really been a country of many diverse religions, and people have gotten along and respected each other. Yeah. So it's sad to see this happen. One philosophical tradition in ancient times, they were known as the Travaka, asserts that only what we know through our five senses exists. Other Indian philosophical schools criticize this nihilistic view, but still regard the people who hold it as rishis or sages. Yeah, they still respect them. In Indian secularism, they are respected by other traditions despite their different philosophy. In the same way, we must all respect those of other religions as well as non-believers. I promote this type of secularism, the essence of which is to be a kind person who does not harm others, whether you are religious or not. So when His Holiness speaks of secularism, this is what he's talking about, okay? In America, secularism has a different meaning, yeah? It means that you generally, you don't like any religion, and you know, and that you're looking, you're in tune with modern values, which religious people often tend to see as lack of values. Okay, you know, when you see the current way in, you know, what Hollywood promotes, yeah, what the government has promoted, you know, many unethical kinds of things, and that's called secular. But that's not His Holiness's meaning of secular. His Holiness's meaning corresponds with the Indian meaning, you know, which is you have respect for all the other religions, even though you don't necessarily follow one or the other. In previous centuries, Tibetans knew little about the rest of the world. We lived on a high and broad plateau, surrounded by the world's highest mountains. Almost everyone, except for a small community of Muslims, was Buddhist, and very few foreigners came to our land. Since we went into exile in 1959, Tibetans have been in contact with the rest of the world. We relate to diverse religions, ethical groups, and cultures with a broad spectrum of views. We also live in a world where modern scientific views are prominent. In addition, Tibetan youth now receive a modern education in which they are exposed to views not traditionally found in the Tibetan community. Therefore, it is imperative that Tibetan Buddhists be able to clearly explain their tenets and beliefs to others using reason. Simply quoting from Buddhist scriptures does not convince people who did not grow up as Buddhists in the validity of the Buddhist doctrine. If we try and prove points only by quoting scripture, these people may respond, "Why should I believe that scripture? Everybody has a book they can quote from." And it's completely true. You know, we have to be able to talk in an articulate way using reason about Buddhist principles and not just quote one sutra or another one, okay? Religion in general faces three principal challenges today: communism, modern science, and the combination of consumerism and materialism. Regarding communism, although the Cold War ended many years ago, communist beliefs and governments still strongly affect life in Buddhist countries. For example, in Tibet, the communist government controls who can ordain as a monk or nun and regulates life in the monasteries and nunneries. It also controls the educational system, teaching children that Buddhism is old-fashioned. Okay, I'm going to go through all of this as he's explaining these three principal challenges and then go back and comment on them, okay? So that was the first one, was communism. Then modern science, the second one, up until now has confined itself to studying phenomena that are material in nature. Because scientists by and large examine only things that can be measured with scientific instruments, this limits the scope of their investigations and consequently their understanding of the universe. Phenomena such as rebirth and the existence of mind as a phenomenon separate from the brain are beyond the scope of scientific investigation. Although they have no proof that these things do not exist, some scientists assume that they do not exist and consider these topics as unworthy of consideration. However, in the last two or three decades, I have met with many open-minded scientists, and we have had mutually beneficial discussions that have highlighted our common points as well as our diverging views. These discussions have been carried out with mutual respect so that both scientists and Buddhists are expanding their worldviews. The third challenge is the combination of materialism and consumerism. Religion values ethical conduct, which may involve delayed gratification, whereas consumerism directs us towards immediate happiness. Religion stresses inner satisfaction, saying that happiness results from a peaceful mind, while materialism tells us that happiness comes from external objects. Religious values such as kindness, generosity, and honesty get lost in the rush to make more money and to have more and better possessions. As a result, many people's minds are confused about what happiness is and how to create the causes of happiness. Okay. Now, the Wall Street Journal published an excerpt from this book some months ago. And one of the things, the sentences that they excerpted from the book was this one about religion faces three principal challenges today: communism, modern science, and the combination of consumerism and materialism. And when they published this article, it was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, which is a very prominent newspaper in America, conservative newspaper. And they had, you know, the places for people writing comments. And it was very interesting because I've, you know, heard His Holiness say this millions of times to the point where I never really thought about, is it still pertinent or not? And many people in the comments thing said, communism is no longer a threat to religion. Yeah, if you look at, you know, communism since the fall of the Soviet Union has largely been discredited. You know, in Beijing, there's so many changes. They have a much more capitalist system than they used to have. Okay? And so many people commented, you know, gee, why is he saying that communism is still, a challenge to religion? Because communism has been largely debunked in many countries. And I was thinking about it, and I thought, yeah, there's a certain truth to that. This was very true, you know, in the past. But now it is changing. Yeah. Then about science being presenting a challenge to religion, then many people in the comments section said, as His Holiness said here, well, now there's all these Buddhist and scientist dialogue. I mean, now when His Holiness comes to the West, he very seldom teaches the Dharma. Most of his teachings are public talks and events with scientists at universities. It's very, very different from previous years where he taught mostly Buddhist groups, okay? And so there's all these scientific dialogues now. There's a whole new department in the university about contemplative studies. Meditation is mainstream. Buy your app that will teach you how to meditate. Okay. And there's differences between science and Buddhism. But there's, you know, now there's so much coming together through these dialogues that some people were saying, well, you know, why is he saying there's a challenge from scientists? Yeah. And it is true. There's been a big shift, you know, because I remember the very early Mind Life conferences, you know, and there wasn't this common reinforcement between Buddhism and science like there is now. Yeah. But most people agreed that materialism and consumerism were still a threat to religion. Yeah, that one people agreed on. Okay. But it's interesting because it made me really think, gee, you know, how often times change. And what many people said in the column, in the comments column, was now fundamentalism is the chief threat to religion, you know, because you have all these religious fundamentalists in every religion, you know, and all the wars that are starting or carried on in the name of religion. And people were saying, oh, that not communism, it's fundamentalism, which is which leads to terrorism and oppression and so on. That's the thing that is a really big challenge to religion now, you know. And I think, you know, there's a lot of truth in that, you know, anywhere from looking at ISIS and the way they twist religion, to the Christian right, to, you know, the conflict in the Middle East, to the Rohingya situation with the Buddhists. You know, it's fundamentalism that is really dangerous in the world nowadays, you know, and all religions have it. They should have a conference with fundamentalism, you know, with fundamentalists. And they would agree on so many things. The only thing they would disagree on is what they're fundamental about. But everything else, you know, the whole thing, mine is right and it's the only way and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Yeah, the fundamentalists say the same thing. As you begin to learn the Buddhist teachings, you may find that some of them are in harmony with your views on societal values, science, and consumerism, and some of them are not. That is fine. Continue to investigate and reflect on what you learn. In this way, whatever conclusion you reach will be based on reasons, not simply on tradition, peer pressure, or blind faith. Now, this is interesting here, yeah, because what you find in the West is many people being attracted to Buddhism because they believe it agrees with their societal values and their values on certain social topics. Because Buddhism is known as being very open-minded, very flexible, and so on, okay? And advocating for peace and nonviolence. And so, you know, a whole group of kind of liberal or progressive people are very attracted to Buddhism for those reasons. But then there's certain Buddhist things that don't agree with certain modern values. And it's interesting to see how sometimes people try and take those things and say, well, His Holiness said this, but actually it means this, you know, rather than just saying, well, there's two things here. One is, on certain topics, you know, His Holiness is a lineage holder. He has to teach what Vasubandhu taught, even though many of the things, I mean, with the structure of the universe, His Holiness, you know, says why he doesn't believe in that. But Vandubasu's explanation of certain ethical things does not at all agree with modern sensibilities. Yeah. And that, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, what happens. Because His Holiness, he has to teach from Vasubandhu. He can there afterwards say, I support this or don't on a personal level, or he may make certain justifications. But he can't totally throw it out because his whole Tibetan community believes this and is supporting this. Yeah? So he's in a difficult position on some issues. As a Western Buddhist, I feel that it's more okay for me to say, okay, Vasubandhu says this. He taught from the perspective of an Indian society in the third or fourth century, and, you know, we're living in the 21st century, and here's how I would adjust the meaning of what Vasubandhu said to fit a contemporary context. And I feel fine saying that. I think it may be, but you know, I'm an Ingie. But it would be really hard for His Holiness to say some of those things, because the Tibetan community would go, but, you know, and quote scripture. Okay. So it's interesting to see what happens. Alex Berzin is also very forthcoming and saying, you know, certain ethical things he explains. Again, he takes what he considers to be the meaning from Vasubandhu and explains that in the context of how things are right now. So now we're on the section that says a broad perspective. Dharma practice is not comprised of simply one meditation technique. This is very important, okay? It's not simply one meditation technique. Our minds are far too complex for one meditation technique or one Dharma topic to transform every aspect of our minds. Although some newcomers to the Dharma may want one simple technique to practice and may see progress by sticking to it, they should not think that in the long term this is sufficient to generate all the realizations of the path. Okay? Yeah, so we find, you know, in many spiritual traditions and many Buddhist traditions, one kind of meditation is taught, and people primarily do that. And His Holiness is saying, you know, that's fine, and if you see progress, that's good, but don't think that that is going to bring all the realizations of the path, okay? Because different meditations are designed for different purposes and touch on different aspects of our mind. And we need to do our mind is very complex, and we need to look in a lot of different nooks and corners, nooks and crannies. Yeah. What are crannies? Corners? Okay. Yeah, I've never thought about that. What's a cranny? You never hear cranny outside of nooks and crannies, do you? Yeah, the microphone's in that cranny. Nobody says that, okay? Anyway, you know, we have to look in many different nooks and crannies of our own mind and flush out so many preconceptions, so many wrong ways of or limited ways of thinking, you know? And so we need many different kinds of meditations to really do this. And this can be very confusing for people who enter the Dharma, yeah? Because we come and like, okay, here's Lam Rim, and here's all the Lam Rim meditations, however many there are, you know? And then you also do all the Nundro practices, you do prostrations, you do mandala offerings, you do vajrasattva, and then there's also tantra, so visualize this deity, but don't just do it that way, visualize this one and that one and the other one and so forth. And then there's fire pujas, and then there's, you know, and so for people coming into Buddhism, sometimes you're just like, what in the world do I practice? There's so many things. Yeah. And it's difficult. It's hard at the beginning, you know, to set up a practice because there's so many things. And then on top of that, you're supposed to learn all the debating material, and you're supposed to learn this and that and the other thing. And, you know, and of course, we want to learn it all now. Okay. We don't want to think in terms of years or decades or lifetimes. We want to learn everything now. So that mentality creates some difficulties for us, you know, that we have to, you know, create a practice for ourselves which emphasizes the things that we feel are really helpful to us in this moment. Yeah, and that balance may change. And we have to keep whatever commitments we've made to our teachers if we've committed ourselves to doing different practices. The Dharma encompasses an entire worldview, and practice necessitates examining all aspects of your life. Some of the Buddha's ideas will be new to you and may challenge some of your deeply held beliefs. Is this true? Does the Dharma poke at some of your beliefs? Yeah? And you find yourself going, but. Okay? So His Holiness says, be open-minded and curious. Investigate these ideas and observe your mind. Check the teachings using reasoning and apply them to your life to see if they describe your experience. Do not accept them simply because the Buddha taught them, and don't reject them simply because they are foreign to your existing ideas. So very good advice. We don't accept them because the Buddha said them, and we don't reject them simply because they differ from the things we already believe. Okay? We try and keep an open mind. If you cultivate a broad outlook and a deeper view about the meaning of life, you will understand not only this life, but also the existence of many lives to come. In addition, you will understand your own happiness and suffering, as well as that of the countless sentient beings who are similar to you in wanting to be happy and avoid suffering. This broad view that considers many lifetimes and many sentient beings will contribute to peace and happiness in this life. So if we have a broad view, you know, that encompasses future lives and liberation and awakening, it actually will contribute to having peace and happiness in this life. Okay? Yeah. So we got to think about that. Yeah. Why should I think about future lives? This is what many people say, including many Buddhists, you know. Why all this emphasis on future lives? I thought the Buddha said we're supposed to be here now. Actually, who was Stephen somebody was the one who authored that book. Do you remember? Was it Ram Dass? Yeah. Oh, be here now? Yeah. I thought, okay, because there was some other community that, anyway, okay, so, you know, be here now. Don't think of the present. I mean, don't think of the future. Don't think of the past. And you find this in Buddhist teachings. You know, very often in Mahamudra, Dzogchen, you know, banish all ideas from the past, from the future. Stay in the present moment. We don't always know how to understand that kind of statement correctly. Yeah. And we often misinterpret it. To think, okay, I just stay in the present moment and enjoy whatever is happening right now. Okay, so I enjoy my sense pleasures because they are happening right now in this present moment. I'm not going to get distracted by past sense pleasures or future ones. I'm going to enjoy the ones that I have now. And there's this story that you hear very often. And there's a big difference between how the Tibetans understand this story and how you hear some Western Buddhist teachers explain it. There's a couple of Asians who explain it differently too. So the story is about a man who fell off a cliff. Yeah, big drop. On his way down, he grasped a branch that was sticking out of the cliff. Okay. And he holds on to that branch for dear life because it's preventing him from going kaboom. But there is a rat eating at the branch that he's holding on to. And that rat is making that branch thinner and thinner and thinner, and eventually it's going to break. But as he's hanging on to that branch, he sees a strawberry. Yeah. And what a beautiful strawberry. And then some people say, as they look at the story, is there you are, you know, death is approaching, the branch is going to break. Enjoy the strawberry while you have it. You know, savor that strawberry. Eat it. It's delicious. Be in the present moment and enjoy the strawberry. The Tibetans look at it and say, the moral of the story is death is coming. Don't be distracted by the strawberry. The sense pleasure from the strawberry is useless if you're going to die. Turn your mind to virtue. So it's interesting how this story, the moral of the story, is different to different people. Okay? I find that very, very interesting. So people often come into Tibetan Buddhism, oh, you talk about future lives, you talk about past negative karma, I thought we were supposed to be in the present and enjoy what is without distraction. Love that delicious strawberry while you have it. Yeah. And they wonder how all this talk of past and present in Buddhism, you know, helps you. So I've thought a lot about this. And the way I've discovered it helps is when I think about karma, yeah, the actions I've done in the past are creating the cause for what I am to be, will become in the future. So I need to pay attention to the past, because I've created a bunch of negative karma that needs to be purified. And if I don't purify it, it's going to not only cause me suffering in the future, but it's going to impede my ability to practice the path. Because that karma will make me make bad decisions. It obscures my mind from understanding the Dharma and so on. So I need to be aware of that, you know, and purify it. Also, my present actions are creating the cause for the future. So I need to think of what kind of future I want to have so that I can create the proper causes for that future. If I want a good rebirth so that I meet the Dharma when I'm young and can continue to practice, I need to be aware of that's the future I want, so I can create the causes that will bring that kind of future now. Okay? So, you know, the Tibetan perspective, where, you know, the past, the present is the only time we ever have to practice. But the present is also very elusive. We cannot pin it down. The present, you know, immediately becomes the past. Yeah. But it still is the only time we have to live, the only time we have to practice. Yeah. And we're the ones who will create the cause for the whatever kind of future we want to have. So we need to be aware of that. Yeah. And the thing is, if we're aware of that and we know what are the causes to practice and what are the causes to abandon, and we're sincere in following the path that does that, then, actually, as a byproduct, we live more in the present because we stop longing for past happinesses because we realize they're in the past and there's nothing there to cling to. We stop longing with attachment for future daydreams because we realize they're only figments of our imagination. And instead, we live ethically with a kind heart now in the present because that's what's going to create the causes for future happiness. So if you look at it this way, awareness of the past and future help us live in the present moment and make our present moment happier because we stop anxiety and worry and fear. Because anxiety, worry, and fear are always about the past and the future. But if we're intent on creating virtue in the present, then we don't go to those past and future worries and fears and anxieties. Okay. Shall we keep reading and finish this chapter? If we are chiefly engrossed with our own personal happiness and problems and do not bother much about the happiness and suffering of others, our vision is quite narrow. When we encounter difficulties, such a limited view will make us think that all the problems of the world have landed on us and we are the most unfortunate person alive. Do you ever feel this way? This pessimistic way of looking at our own life will make it difficult for us to be happy here and now, and we will drag ourselves through life day and night. Okay, and that's because we have such a narrow view. You know, whatever is happening to me now, my suffering is the worst thing in the world. Yeah, and how that view on life causes so much unhappiness. On the other hand, if we have a wider view and are aware of the experiences of other sentient beings, then when we encounter difficulties, we will understand that unsatisfactory experiences are not isolated cases happening to us alone, but are the nature of cyclic existence. They happen to everyone. This mental attitude will help us to maintain stability in life and to face the situations we encounter in a productive way. To take it a step further, if we do not think solely about the betterment of this life and allow for the possibility of many subsequent lives, then when we encounter difficulties in the present, we will be better able to weather them and remain positive about the future. Thinking only about the pleasures of this life and putting all our hopes in this life alone, we will feel let down when things inevitably do not turn out the way we want. Therefore, a broad perspective of life and an understanding of the nature of dukkha, suffering and dissatisfaction, helps us to improve our life now and in many lives to come. In the first two of the four truths, the Buddha described dukkha and its causes. We may wonder, why should I think about this? It will only make me more depressed and unhappy. Although reflecting on dukkha and its causes may initially bring some uneasiness, suffering is still there even if we do not think about it in this systematic and purposeful way. If we simply let things take their course, suffering will strike when we are unaware and overwhelm us. We will be confounded regarding the nature of dukkha, its causes, and how to eliminate it, and feelings of hopelessness and desperation may further complicate our situation and make us even more miserable. Yeah, it's very true. You know, look at our own experience. Say we undergo a certain illness or injury for which we are not prepared. We have the suffering of the ailment, And on top of that, we also suffer feelings of shock and vulnerability. But if we know about a physical condition and calmly accept it, we go to a doctor for treatment. Because we have accepted the existence of that ailment and are ready to deal with it, even if the doctor prescribes surgery, we will accept it with happiness because we know we are following a method to remove the suffering. Similarly, if we know and accept the unsatisfactory nature of cyclic existence, we will be in a much better position to deal with it when it occurs. We should not simply wait until a tragedy strikes us, but reflect on cyclic existence, learn about it, and have a method to face it. As we now go on to investigate other topics, it's important that you know that I am nothing special. I am a human being just like you. We all have the same potential, and that is what makes one person's experience relevant and expressible to others. If you have the idea that the Dalai Lama is some extraordinary, special kind of being, then you may also think that you cannot relate to or benefit from what I say. That is foolish. Some people think I have healing powers. If I did, I would have used them to avoid gallbladder surgery, which he had a few years back. It is because we are the same that you may be able to derive some benefit from my words and experiences. Okay? So His Holiness, you know, is really saying we need a big view. And, you know, thinking about dukkha, unsatisfactory experiences or suffering, thinking about that, thinking about what causes it, afflictions and karma, you know, it's not light, love, and bliss. But what His Holiness is saying is that if we think about that, we understand the universal experience of it, we know how afflictions and karma produce suffering. And then because of that, we're motivated to find methods to reduce that suffering. And we investigate the thought training teachings and we train our mind and, you know, we do purification practice. Then when suffering occurs, and it will for sure, 100% guaranteed, you don't need a fortune teller, you know, then when we know that dukkha will occur and we're prepared for it, then we don't freak out. We don't panic. We don't say, woe is me, I've had it. I'm so anxious, I'm free, you know, I'm like, I don't know what to do. Because we've thought about it beforehand, we've accepted that's the reality, we've developed techniques to help our mind deal with the suffering. And then when it comes, you know, it's, we can deal with it. We don't freak out. Okay. 3 minutes for questions.
I'm curious, Venerable Children, did the Jewish leaders question you about why you became a nun?
Yeah, of course they questioned.
Yeah, know. Were they friendly in their questioning or like, how dare you, you're one of us?
Oh, well, they were friendly and behind it was, how dare you, you're one of us. Yeah, but they were very nice in it. They weren't pushy. At other times when I was in Israel, I met certain people who were really very unhappy with me becoming a Buddhist. Yeah. But then other people who, you know, just accepted it and were okay. And then some people who, like, at one friend's house in the West Bank, you know, they were settlers in the West Bank, and we went there for Shabbat dinner one time. And her uncle would not look at me. Yeah, would not greet me at all. But what to do?
Did you have a chance to discuss with the Jewish rabbi that you meditated with what kind of meditation he did, or was he curious about what you did?
Yeah, we talked a lot about that. Yeah. I can't remember specifics now, but we definitely talked about that.
This might be a bit of a silly question, but did the Buddha ever, could any of his teachings ever be interpreted as contradictory because he would say some different things to different people? So were any of his teachings ever perceived as contradictory because of that?
Well, I'm sure some people perceived it as contradictory. But the Buddha, you know, once you, if you have a big mind and once you're able to really understand the nature of reality deeply, then those people did not say that.
Yeah. I have two questions from online.
Mm-hmm.
One said, would Venerable provide an example of how she, Alex Berzin, or His Holiness may disagree with the views of Vasubandhu? I'm not familiar with what she was referencing.
Okay. Well, for example, Vasubandhu's position on unwise and unkind sexual behavior. Okay? I remember one of my teachers was teaching this one time, and he was saying, you know, if, this is from Vasubandhu, that if somebody else has paid for a prostitute and you take her instead, that is breaking that precept. And I nearly went through the ceiling. Because it was condoning prostitution and not at all recognizing the suffering that women go through and or acknowledging how women are sold into prostitution and so on, you know. So that's one example, okay? And there's several more.
And then the second question was, would Venerable help us understand how to see His Holiness as Chinrezi, but also as a sentient being, how to have the proper view?
Okay. Well, His Holiness, you know, when people, we all, you know, Westerners, foreigners, anybody, Chinese, go, are you really Chinrezi? You know? And His Holiness says, no, I'm just a simple Buddhist monk. Okay? So, can't Chinrezi be a simple Buddhist monk? Okay. But His Holiness doesn't like us, all this kind of fluff, where people worship him and do not listen to what he's teaching.